I do believe that the title of the course scared a lot of people off. I don't run a business. I'm not a legislator that I have to worry about passing laws. I really do. I mean, people, if this was a conference of the course about, you know, Jewish holidays or about, like, the passing any tax code that we just had, people, that was something people thought they could relate to, and again, business ethics. No, I run my little business. I don't do much. I do my job. I don't worry about it. And therefore...
I've done only one translation through your home.
So even though, you know, the president spoke the other night, and of course the whole focus was on the economy and jobs, and everybody will tell you that the election is coming up, and all the focus is on the economy and finances, and everybody's worried about it, everybody's talking about it, but there is an ethical side to it as well. So this is something I think could have been marketed a little bit different. Instead of calling it Jewish business ethics, could have been marketed as a Jewish look at the economy and what is best for the economy, what is moral in the economy, what is ethical in the economy, and things like that. Because that's what we're going to be talking about.
Really, that would have been it.
Now, the danger here, there is a natural trap that we tend to fall into, and that is, when we look at the Torah's perspective on things, Judaism's perspective on things, we tend to try to fit it into our already well-defined personal biases. If you're a socialist, you know, the Torah is socialist and communal-based. If you're a capitalist, the Torah is all about capitalism. You know, whatever personal approach I have, we try to wedge the Torah's views into that. We have to come at it with an open mind and a willingness to see something new, especially when we're talking about something like ethics. Moral dilemma. What's a moral dilemma? I go into Walmart, and I see the latest, newest, hottest iPhone, and I'm faced with a moral dilemma. Should I steal it or should I... It's not a moral dilemma. Right? What's a moral dilemma?
Walking into Walmart
itself,
knowing that they're for an employee.
Why is that a moral dilemma?
Because, I mean, how do you got, on the one hand, we want
you... Shut up! You already explained what a moral dilemma is. You used two Aramaic words, you said, Mikhadida, on the one hand, and then the other hand, and on the other hand, in other words, a moral dilemma is when you have two principles that you hold dear. And now, they're in conflict. That's a moral dilemma. I'm going to have to trample on something. Which one gets trampled? When there's only one principle at stake, and your choice is to follow the principle or not follow, that's not a moral dilemma, that's personal choice. That's, are you going to be a good person today? You're not going to be a good person today. So that's a moral dilemma where today, one of my dearly, deep felt principles is going to be broken. The question is, which one? Even that is not always clear-cut. Because what are the principles? What are the values that we are talking about that they're not always easily defined? And every person looks at the world through different lenses. There's a joke where this guy is asking the rabbi, I have a moral dilemma. He said, yesterday I was in the office, I was in the store, and a guy came in, and he bought $5 worth of merchandise, he gave me a 10, I gave him $5 change, and he walked out. Then I looked at the bill in my hand, I realized he'd given me $100 instead of a 10. Rabbi, what do I do now? Do I have to tell my partner about the extra $90? Or do I not tell my partner about the extra
$90? Everybody's trying to get the guy. Right. Oh my goodness.
In other words, to this person.
Oh my goodness.
To this person.
You violate the thing
that
I can't include you now.
Wait a minute.
What's that? Then
But here, the point is that this businessman is very worried about the ethics of how he deals with the partner. He's not so worried about the ethics of how he deals with
the guy who's
customer.
Yeah.
Wait, this sounds horrible. But let's turn it around. I go into Walmart, right? Our favorite villainous supermarket. I go into Walmart, and I give the lady a 10, and she gives me $5 change, and I walk in the parking lot, I realize she didn't give me 5, she gave me a 50.
You go back and you bring it back. No,
$1 corporation? What if I'm already halfway back home? I've been visiting Atlanta and I'm halfway back home.
Happened to me before and I've gone back. You go back. There's no question there.
For you, there's no question there. But for many people, the question is, it depends who, it depends if there's a social worker. I don't feel I'm the capitalist. I'm not a dishonest person. But this is not a person. This is Walmart. Or they make a mistake and they send you a tax refund that's you know, $500 too much.
That I would probably call
us. You would call the IRS.
That's the Jews who are going to Israel.
Well, I would call. We
got to go back to life and I left the same folks. He said, don't worry.
We'll go there. Exactly right. So these are all the Jewish business jokes, the ethical jokes that we're talking
about. Is that the truth?
Okay. So,
I have a question. So what's the difference to get the tax refund? I mean, you know, Walmart,
that's interesting. I'm sitting here going, Well, because I was thinking of the person who has to balance that register. So I was also thinking about that person. If the government sends me an extra $500, I'm thinking they know more than I do that they owe me $500 extra. I mean, I'll give you an example. Seriously, I just got my stamp on my passport, thinking I was going to originally go to Israel. And I just last week, now this was a couple months ago, right, when we first talked about it, because I realized it was coming up. And they sent me, the Treasury Department sent me $25, and it said for passport. Now, I didn't go back yet and look at what I sent them, but somehow they decided that whatever I sent them, $25 more, but I didn't even check yet. I just took it for face value, so that would be my answer.
Or another thing, let's say you order something online. You're right, but the cashier, let's remove the cashier from the equation. You order something online, and they send you two of them.
I was going with that recall.
This is part of the year, you know. Do I have to go to the hassle? And the point is that the moral dilemma is when two principles are conflicting. And again, as you see the world, your question will be different. And certainly, your answer will be different. So let's move along and see how this works out.
20 years, I gave it one most fight. It wasn't supposed to. So I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I went and I bought a savings bond. I said, I'll just lend it back to them. If I say something, I'll just cash the money and just give them the gift back.
Yeah.
Did they ever
say anything? That was in the 20 years. And it's been a long time since I've been out. I don't make anything to get away.
Otherwise,
you're making this guilty by it.
We know two pilots, you know, went to Antigua. I talked to the lead pilot, he's in Maxwell. The miracles, you know, they picked him up and he said, going back to Israel, they had stand that it's not the one way you don't get fuel. So they did. So these two guys came out there and he said, send it up. So he gave him a credit card. So he said,
the various things we're going to talk about throughout this course are lesson one. Today we're going to talk about insider trading. But insider trading sounds like, you know, I'm not in the stock market, what do I care? But insider trading essentially is information imbalance. One side has more information than the other, and that makes the playing field unlevel? Not level. Lesson number two, we're going to talk about the idea of a living wage. So what does Jewish tradition say about minimum wage and how much the poor somebody needs to be compensated? So in lesson three, we'll talk about debt. Certainly there's no such thing as debtor's prison in Judaism, but what do you do with overwhelming debt? Lesson number four, we'll talk about the traditional Jewish view on unions, collective bargaining, and equally important, the ability or the righteousness or the allowance of striking. Are you allowed to strike on your job? And if yes, is that apply to everybody? I believe, I remember it wasn't that long ago when the rabbis in Israel, or some of the rabbis in Israel, came out against, vehemently against teachers' right to strike. Is that such a thing? teacher, you're responsible for children, you have the right. No, that's right. So, what is the traditional Jewish view on things like that? Lesson number 5. We'll talk about the very touchy subject of excessive salaries. Is this such a thing as too much? This is the thing. If you know, somebody's making a fortune, somebody's making, you know, $30-40 million a year, where the rest of us are making, you know, less than $100,000, less than $50,000 in many cases. What's going on? And finally, lesson 6, we'll talk about a lot of the ethics that apply to us in our daily life, with regard to the marketplace. For example, traditionally, we're told you're not allowed to walk into a store with no intention of buying anything. And, you know, bows and ask the salesman some questions and how about this and how about that. Today, you know, we went from window shopping to actually shopping, but with no intention of buying. And unless, we'll talk a little bit more about it, obviously, in that lesson, but unless that's the way that the business is set up, like bookstores, like many department stores, but there are those of us who know that there are people who make use of the services that the stores provide with the intention of making a sale with no intention of buying.
Mm.
Right? So that's a little bit of a misrepresentation of your intentions. All right. These kinds of ethics as we go through the class. There are a few main objectives. Certainly we're not going to solve any tricky, sticky issues here. We're not, but we will learn what it means to be an expert rabbi in these fields. This is why not every rabbi, not everybody with the title rabbi is authorized to rule on these matters. And of course, these matters are as tricky as any other.
Like if you go to your rabbi and you don't have an answer, then where does one go?
Your rabbi should have a rabbi.
Oh, you pick the rabbi and give the answer.
First of all, you have to know the right question. But no,
the truth
is that the job of most rabbis is to know who to ask.
I've never
known. Right. Because obviously you can't be an expert on everything, and most of us are not an expert on anything. We just need to know who to ask. And when it comes to financial issues, and indeed, Jews have been going to rabbinic courts, Torah courts, right from the very beginning of time, of the Jewish people, and down through to today. When two Jews have a dispute, they are required by Torah law to go to a Jewish court. And a dispute could be anything like property rights and the financial issues and buying and selling and all this stuff. And there's more about it. So that's objective number 1. We're going to become familiar with some of the key principles of ethics and values when it comes to the marketplace. And objective number 2, of course, is to see, again, as we do in all of these classes, how the Torah is applicable in a very real way and in a very modern sense to our lives. And it's not just the law that was written in the desert so many thousands of years ago, but rather it has come down to us with amazing consistency and at the same time flexibility to be applicable to the modern world. And then, of course, we're going to have some work cut out for us to try to understand the core subject and the core values that are the platform, that are the foundation of all of this that we call ethics and financial values. And of course, when we walk out of here, we're not going to be online experts. If you walk out of here knowing what questions to ask, we will have accomplished a lot. So, this is part of the discussion that we'll have today. I don't know what that was. Okay, let's get into the market first.
No, my
mind. Okay. What is the mind?
What is it?
Trading, things of value.
Yeah.
Buying and selling transactions, and in most cases, at least we hope, in the common sense of the marketplace, both the buyer and the seller are winners.
Right.
Are winners. It's supposed to be a win-win situation. The farmer is gladly parting with the bushel of apples so that you could go home with all the apples you ever wanted. You are gladly parting with fair price. That amount of money to buy the apples. So he's getting his money, you're getting your apples, everybody's happy. That's called a win-win situation. That's called a transaction. And since everybody is doing so willingly, that's what makes it balanced.
And how would you put foreclosures in there? So you've gone to the bank, and now you lost your job, and your wife lost your job, and so...
It's going to be complicated. Just based on what we just said about the marketplace.
Right.
So what's the question?
Well,
the bank owns your house.
Oh, so they just decided to take it back.
Without any other ethical and legal consideration?
That's fair.
That's what happens. They give you money, and the stipulation is, either you give me your money or you give me your house.
That makes sense. Okay.
So in the very real sense of the market, that's called...
You know,
taking risks. Business. However, that's when everybody goes in with their eyes open. But sometimes, one side, either the buyer or the seller, knows something that is not available to the public. And now, it's not just a purchase, it's not just a transaction. Now it begins to feel like taking advantage. And that's really the explanation of what insider trading is. What is insider trading? First of all, trading is simply trading pieces of a company. Right? A share is literally a piece of a company. And so people buy and sell shares, stocks in the company, for whatever the world, the market thinks the whole company is worth, divided by how many shares there are, and that's how much the share is worth. What's insider trading?
Knowing that it's no free, or more, or less.
What's the word insider?
Somebody.
Knowledge that you don't have.
Right. Somebody on the inside who knows that tomorrow our company is about to fall apart, he knows information that nobody else knows. Somebody
on the other side. Somebody who knows tomorrow our company is going to be hit a great big time.
Okay, that's what insider trading. So, insider means you are a person on the inside who has information not available to the general public, and that gives you an unfair advantage. We call it insider trading, even if you're not an insider. If you're the insider's next door neighbor, and he's giving you information, by extension, that makes you an insider, right?
I have a real life example of something I did that made me an insider. I worked for Sun Guard Data Systems, and Y2K happened. I knew we were going to have a problem, actually, out of a huge corporation that's all over the world. There was only one issue logged, and that was by me, because the old internet browsers had a security issue. We couldn't log in. But I had bought everything I had, and I bought all the stock, because it went in the tank, because of Y2K, and knew we wouldn't have an issue, and the stock would climb back up. I took everything I had and bought a massive amount of stock and made big gains. It was an insider trade. Knowing, having faith in the company that we wouldn't falter. I didn't have any...
You did have information other people didn't have.
Wait, you're talking about information. You had information based on your expertise in computers, not based on your inside information about the company.
Right.
So, okay. This becomes a little tricky now.
Yeah.
So, before we get to that, insider trading wasn't always illegal. Early on, in the days of the stock markets, it was perfectly natural that people with inside information had an advantage, and that's why they made a living. That's why a lot of people got rich.
How long ago was that? Because when I was married, my husband came back with a check from Cathay Airlines, and I said to him, after I found out about it, why didn't you tell me? We could have bought some stock in Boeing, and it would have gone up. He said, that's insider trading. Is it?
Unless you are approximately 100 years old, it would be illegal. Because it was after the 1929 crash that we began to be a little bit more aware of the downside of insider trading. What would be wrong with insider trading?
Okay.
Or morally wrong.
Yeah. Why?
You get to jump on the next guy.
So, we all want to jump.
All that eggs in my business is what kind of guarantee you get to sit on the farm. You know what I tell them? An in-yard farm. It's
just risky.
And of course, that means that you get that part out of the yard, you guarantee it. Is that good enough? An in-yard farm.
What if the inside information is wrong?
It could be. That's what you don't know.
It was a very, very thin information.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the thing.
Our bosses love you. Thank you, Chef.
Walked away with it. I know somebody, a real good friend of mine, lost $3 million on a cowboy. because he said he won't do it, and he doesn't.
So let me ask you a question. The guy you're talking about, Sam Waxall, what did he do wrong?
It wasn't Sam Waxall. He wasn't the one that told.
He's the owner of the company. He's the CEO of the company.
He was iClone's owner.
And
he
wanted to be sold, he sold his job, first thing.
And he called the assistant, who called the broker, and the broker actually called my computer, but nothing happened to him.
Now, in the market, he made a sale. What did he sell in the market?
Who?
Waxall. What did he sell?
Every last share of his...
No. But what? Every last share, what did he sell? What was he selling? What did he bring to market? Did he bring bread to the market with rotten eggs in it, and he knew those eggs were rotten when he made that bread? He knows it's going to make people sick.
So he sold the stock.
He brought rotten stock to the market. He sold rotten stock. He knew that stock was rotten.
Ah. Okay. And so that was not the
application. He knew that they were not going to develop that cancer drug.
Right.
That could speak for the whole work and the whole company.
Well, sure. It was going to be a big hit. And it did, and it helped. So
he did something wrong at the very bottom. The first phone call.
Well, so now my question to you is, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with selling your stock in your company when you know it's going to tank?
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Or is that just business?
Yeah. Well, obviously it wasn't just business, because nothing happened to him, but I recall that was part of my frustration about Martha Stewart. Whether you like her or not, okay, it was, why did she...
By the way, she was never convicted on this other trade.
It was lying. It was lying.
So the question is, what is wrong with insider trading?
Something has knowledge that other people don't, it's not equitable. Well, the thing always has knowledge that other people
don't. Brings rotten stock to the market. It makes trades that happen in the market that are
like
rotten trades. They're bad trades, so you can't trust. You have this issue of, can you trust the market?
So then let's say it was the reverse. Let's say the FDA was about to approve the drug, and he knew this. They knew the stock was going to shoot through the roof, and he went out to buy more stock. Is that okay? He's not bringing rotten eggs.
It's
he's getting a jump on the market.
If you can't afford a house, how can you get a loan to do it?
Let me point this in a specific direction. Tell me what's wrong with insider trading without using the word fair, because fair is not a legal term. You can't go to a judge and say it's not fair. There has to be a legal principle at stake before we say this is wrong. So what's wrong with insider trading? Don't use the word unfair.
You have to represent. You bring something to the market, to the trading place, and you represent it at a certain value and say it's this. Then it has to be what that value is.
He didn't do anything. He didn't say anything. He went to the marketplace and he said, here, I have this for sale. How much do you want for it? So how much do you pay for it?
That it's going to be worth a lot.
And that's how the market works. People buy and sell all the time.
Well, they only move up the material. How much the stock is at? I cost $2 to fly for the answer is, and I say the same thing, they're not getting enough money for the company.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how it's going to line up. You can own one share of stock, go down there and raise $100 worth of devil, but if you own one share, but the guy who's got the most stock is going to do what? He's going to control the books. I know the IRS real well. They own it. And if they say yes or no, then it'll be sold.
I did not. You said it earlier. And I guess that's what I'm trying to get over for. If both parties don't benefit in the market at all times, if we don't make this a rule of the market, we both have to benefit. And what eventually happens to the market?
Okay, there you go.
Okay, in the beginning, right.
The prime reason why they started making laws against insider trading was confidence in the market. If I know that people out there know much more than I do, and I have access to information that I can't possibly have, and if I don't know what I'm buying,
you get to trust, so there's a word trust.
There has to be a sense of confidence in the system, otherwise you will not encourage participation. That's a very important principle. Another principle is, you have a responsibility to act in the best interest of the shareholders of the company, not only in your own best interest.
That's true. Yes. Fiduciary responsibility.
Right? And here's something interesting. This comes up in a Supreme Court case. insider information. The question is, who does the information belong to?
Mm.
It's insider information, meaning, apparently, at least according to one court, this information belongs to the company. It's not yet available to the public. It belongs to the company. And when you are doing business with information, it doesn't belong to you. So you have somehow misappropriated somebody else's property. In this case, the property is information.
I'm not necessarily misappropriated. It is the property because it just come your way.
But it's not yours. If somebody accidentally gave you somebody's car, that's unfair. If somebody accidentally gave you a company car, that doesn't make the car yours.
No, but I'm saying if someone accidentally gave you information.
Here the court is treating information like property.
Mm-hmm.
You have no right to use it without
it
being...
So you see something on your boss's desk that, when you stand over something on your boss's desk, it's no different than somebody accidentally hearing something until you get information off your boss's desk.
These are all very loosely defined problems. And the truth is that insider trading is still not so hammered out in American law. And we're still developing, and we're still trying to figure out how best to handle it. And somehow they forgot to tell the politicians that they can't do insider trading. Somehow that got lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
First university business ethics class was taught in 1983 at Harvard University.
1983?
The first business ethics class.
Wow, that's
right. You could buy it, you would have it over
jail. I don't know how you would define the first business ethics class, but we're going to get to a case that's about a 2,000 years old.
Collegiate? Yes, and I completely conceded what you meant.
Now, the point is that... This field is still being developed, so to speak, in American law. What do halakhos say about insider trading?
Well, Yoda, what is it, Yoda? If Isaac can cook it from Yoda, and
the answer is not much.
That's not, insider trading? It's not to the.
Obviously, they're not going to call it insider.
Right.
But more than that.
I can't believe that this would have been covered because
I've been reading.
If not taking what is it, interest from the money to the credit that I have had for many, many years now, which might come out later.
I made money off of her.
I can't believe that it hasn't been covered in some way. It may not be called that, but I cannot believe that it has not been.
But there's two reasons why there is very little information in modern halakha books. In modern rabbis talks about modern issues. Very little has been spoken about insider trading for two very important reasons. Number one, obviously they're not going to call it insider trading, right?
I didn't know that word.
But more than that, there is a very important principle that we have to understand throughout the entire length of this course, and that is the Torah tells us to follow local law so that if it's illegal by American law, it's illegal according to the Torah. You don't have to ask the rabbi. So the guy goes to his lawyer and says, can I do this? And says, no. He doesn't then turn around and go say to the rabbi, well, what do you say?
Right, he's already been told because that's...
That's right.
That's like the IRS calls the synagogue and says, Rabbi Goldberg, it says here that Mr. Shapiro gave a $100,000 donation to the synagogue. Did he do so? The rabbi said, sure, he will.
Not a problem.
You know, that's why I did this Jewish girl was flying with his rabbi and the door came up. That plane and that real rich Jew said, you know what, if we get out of this, I'll give half of my fortune to the shul. Everything got calm, good, they landed. We played the rug, called him up, said, you ready to make your commitment? He said, no, I'll tell you something, Rabbi, I'll give the Lord a better commitment. He said, what's that? He said, if he'll catch my suckers up now, I'll give him the right thing, I'll give him everything.
Double or nothing.
So, I'm thinking about something. It's not insider trading, but to me, it's going to be the same. It involves this, the same thing of questionable. For instance, a merchant may come to a friend of his, the guy that may live next door, so may a distributor or something. We're getting a shipment of meat or lumber or fertile, whatever. And I'm going to give you this price before the piece goes on sale next week at full retail. isn't the same principle involved where some people have advantage over the rest of us?
Yeah.
And it's not insider trading, but to me, it may not be called insider, but to me, I see no difference.
So you're saying that my professor in school that's really educated himself, my finance professor that's just made so much money on just sitting and day trading, and what he learned to talk to himself about finance and how the market works, and he makes so much money by sitting there doing that. I could never sit down trading and look at stocks and do that. And the man made me look at companies and examine companies and what's going on with how much they have and assets and debts and where they have this stuff, how much liquidity the companies have, and what's going on with the contracts. Drug companies specifically is what we looked at. And, you know, this guy made a lot of cash. So that's different than somebody who has knowledge that they wrap something on their boss's desk.
Yes,
with this FDA contract, that can happen tomorrow.
We have specials in the wholesale end all of the time for those people that...
Right. Same way.
But I was, you know, going on back to him because I was relating it back to what he was saying in terms of lumber or meat, okay? And I'm going to give you a deal before I give everybody else a deal. Because we know everything.
Principles that we hold dear, and then decide which behavior is violating those principles. Because again, we've had a hard time telling, besides the idea that we don't like it, and it's unfair, we've had a hard time defining why insider trading is wrong. So let's talk about the principles. Again, we're not going to find a direct reference to insider trading in a lot of books very much, but we are going to find important ethical principles. And here's where we begin to see that how you look at something colors your question and certainly colors your answer. So let's look at page 5. We're on page 5 and we have a case study of a defective home. This is written a couple thousand years ago by a Roman philosopher named Marcus Tullius Cicero. And he has all of these ethical dilemma situations. Case study number 2 on page 5. Suppose that an honest man wants to sell a house because of certain defects, of which he alone is aware. The building is supposed to be quite healthy, but is in fact insanitary, and he is aware that it is. Or the place is badly built and falling down, but nobody knows this except the owner. Suppose he does not disclose these facts to the purchasers, and he sells the house for much more than he expected. Has he behaved unfairly and dishonestly? Well, he keeps quoting two different opinions. One was the opinion of a famous Greek Stoic. And the Stoics were essentially, for lack of time and long-winded explanations, the Stoics believed in morality liberalis. Exactly, ethical moral thought. Diogenes was the Stoic teacher. He had a student named Antipater, and they constantly went at it. So the question is, has he behaved unfairly and dishonestly by selling a bad house? Certainly he has, says Antipater. And Athens, not to set a man right when he has lost his way, is penalized by general execration. And is it not precisely the same thing to let a purchaser make a mistake and ruin himself with a very heavy loss? That is even worse than not showing the man the way, since in this case the purchaser is being deliberately misled. Says Antipater, that's horrible. But he didn't force you to buy, did he? Says the Athenian.
He didn't even ask you to. He offered for sale something he didn't want. You bought something you wanted. So when the purchaser can exercise his own judgment, what fraud can there be on the part of the seller? It would surely be exceptionally stupid of a seller to enumerate the defects of what he is selling. And the height of absurdity for the auctioneer to proclaim at the owner's request, insanitary house for sale.
Wow. Caveat emptor.
That's exactly right.
That's against the law now.
Specifically in the case of houses. But do we expect the guy who's selling tomatoes to say, rotten tomatoes?
No, but also, if you go to a garage sale and there's a television, and it's $10, you're going to assume it's still going to function. That's the assumption. It works.
You can tear the internet tall and maybe fire
you. Well, you know what a vendor, what's a vendor? That's how this hire.
Phone, not call.
Yeah.
All
right, no.
So vendors.
Okay. So now, Diogenes says, hey, as long as you don't tell a lie, as long as you don't go up there and say, there's nothing wrong with this house, all you're saying is, I have an answer to that. You are not misrepresenting anything. You haven't done anything wrong. And Tipiter says, absolutely not. You're preying on the fact that the buyer has does not have the information you have. What does it tell us
there? Will be making very low gross tax.
Yeah, well, you can't be sure.
You got
the understanding? Do not put a stumbling block. Do not take advantage of, don't take advantage of someone who's not aware.
Perfect.
Okay.
Let's look at some of the halakhic principles to see if we can figure out who do we agree with. Do we agree with Diogenes, that as long as you are honest, the sale is valid? Or do we agree with Antipater, that because you were not forthright?
Is that going to be depending on how each person is going to have their own value system inside that it's going to be tainted by?
Well, there is such an approach that morality and justice comes from within, and therefore everybody's different. But the Torah has to have universal values that we have to give. And in many cases, it does come down to what the person expected, what is the local custom and tradition. Today, if you sell something, if you sell a house, if you sell a car, there are lemon laws, right? So the buyer is a little bit more protected than he would have in other cases be. But for the most part, we say, hey, I'm selling. You're buying.
You don't to tell what you buy. I sold my house 3 years ago, and I came over and said, they won't inspect it, and I know it's not going to buy it. I said, here's what I need. I said, when I married her 60 years ago, I didn't know how she was going to sell my house.
Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at
warranty.
We're going to look at something called Gnevas Da'at. Gnevas Da'at. Sure, we all know about stealing. And Gnev, of course, means stealing. Stealing property, stealing money, that's a no-no by everybody's standards. But then there's such a thing as called stealing only based on information, meaning misleading. Let's look at text 3A on page 6. Jeff, want to read?
A person is forbidden to act in a sleaze tongue or alluring manner, saying one thing outwardly and thinking otherwise in one's heart. It is forbidden to deceive people. One should not press a colleague to share a meal when one knows that the colleague will not accept the invitation, nor should one press presents upon a colleague knowing that the colleague will not accept them. The same applies to all matters of this sort.
What's going on here? What's the problem? Why can't I invite somebody to dinner if I know that they're not coming?
Well, how did you know that they're not coming?
I overheard him say to a friend of his going out of town for the weekend.
Turn it around.
What was your intention? So why would you want to invite him?
Did he benefit from something
that's
I
get credit for the invitation.
Because so why don't you invite him when you know that he can't come?
Well,
because then I've got something else with you. I mean, it's
in other words, I am putting myself out there as this kind, welcoming, inviting person.
But you aren't.
But I'm not.
If you know already that he can't come, how is that being kind?
Well, I didn't tell him that I know he can't come.
And they're talking about
college.
So it's the business of our
You don't ask us. We don't believe in laying it all out there. But we also don't think what we're saying here is you do not take overt action to mislead somebody. Even if the only thing that you are stealing here is information.
But aren't we also being judged every day by the camera and these very same things? So who are we really trying to impress or
Well, just by stealing, the only, you know, we're ignoring God for a moment. We're trying to impress our neighbors.
I say God's going to be struck with me. I don't know why. I've been grown up and asked the fellow and had a half there. He said he wanted to buy it. I said, that's what's good. But he said, I say one thing. I ain't putting any blacks. You understand? He was all told. He said, oh, I said, all right. So I knew a black where he wanted to work for me. And I sent him out there and he started measuring his lot. So he looked out there and, you know, that he thought he was going to buy. He called and said, well, now I think I'm going to buy a thing right now. It was the next day that he sent a contract to me where he called it. Well, he called me out to argue with him about the charge that I fixed him in.
So we don't like misrepresent.
All right, it's forbidden to big people in Congress.
Well, you know, the next, Carlin,
yeah.
Hang on, so you need to text Ruby. You want me to text Nick? Yeah.
Can I have my
phone?
Ruby.
It's forbidden to trick people in commerce or to deceive them. For example, if merchandise is blemished, one must inform the customer. Likewise, one should not sell a Gentile non-kosher meat as if it was kosher.
In other words,
even a
Gentile surprise
for your family.
You see that?
Well,
surprise
is never seen.
What's wrong? Does a Gentile have to keep kosher?
No.
So what's wrong with selling him non-kosher meat?
Well, not if you say it's kosher.
You're benefiting from a non-kosher animal. If merchandise is blemished, one must inform the customer.
That's too genuine.
That's not going to happen. Just like in our business, scrap. You're not supposed to put a certain amount of scrap in with the rest of scrap. But they do it. They may put a little bit in there. If they have a big pile over a month, they'll get rid of all the stuff that they should have never put in there. And everybody will tell you that, no, I don't do that. But you go visit them and you know they do that.
No, but this is against
so you. It happens ever. So when is it? You going to get caught?
Have you ever heard of it?
More from the very beginning.
So Fort Landing, okay, well, we won't get into it. It takes that to the limit. Once you go to a restaurant, you want to know where this chicken comes from, how it was raised. And they just take it to the limit where they show you the papers from the farm that it came from,
who
his parents.
It has to do with the scrap, I guarantee. They got, right now, we just, you'd have to have the content, how much this carbon, this, and that. Just like you go to the doctor, do all this stuff, the blood work and everything else. And when you buy some steel or lumber, you have to furnish the papers. How much carbon, how much sulfur, and so forth. Different pencil strength and all that.
So, but what do we say about misinformation or selling blemished products? This is, we don't like it because it's unfair. It's morally wrong. Is it legally wrong? Is it somehow law? Is it some Torah law that somehow is being trampled on? And the answer is yes. There is a concept called mekachos, which means purchasing under misapprehension.
Spell that.
Mekach.
Mekach. C-H-A. Misapprehension or misinformation?
Yeah, there's a buyer or the seller, somebody, doesn't know what's going on.
So if you're a vendor in New York City and you're selling shirts and they're really, really cheap, so I guess you have to tell the people the reason I'm selling cheap is because they're missing a point.
No, you just have to know
that.
Or unless it's assumed. I tell you what, I was in Israel.
Because
the way that's like what American joke. He buys watermelons for $1 and sells them for 50 cents.
Yeah,
how do you make a living if you sell a lot of watermelons? There's just a big quantity and I don't think they are known to sell blemished stuff.
No.
They just
Jewish woman went to the bank. about where. So they went on most of the papers that I'm going to present, and he said, that's tens of dollars. So she looked across the paper, they had one that looked just like it, already worth $10. Yeah, so it's right. She said, I should care what the sheep do at night.
Come back to the question.
What is that got
to do with your pattern here? Selling shirts.
And some are blemished and some are not?
No, and
then if it's known, then the shirt will post. I'll tell you. So I was in Israel, and we were in Tiberias, and there was a guy in the street there, and he's selling CDs. And I saw some singer that I hadn't heard in a while. I bought a couple of CDs at the moment. My shekel, which comes out to be $1.25 or something for a CD, it was great. And I take it to the box, and I open it on my CD player, and I pull up the plastic, and I open the thing, and it's a photocopy. The cover was a photocopy piece of paper. And the CD wasn't, it was one of the homemade CDs. And I was, oh my God, it's a ripoff. And the lady next to me says, duh, you paid $1.25. What did you think you were buying?
Yeah, what's your name?
Okay, so isn't
that what
we programmed on our head? Yeah, we made that.
You can
offer up. Yeah, another example. He was misrepresenting it. Yeah, and so besides the illegality of it,
it wasn't ethical.
The point is that I know that on the street you're going to get junk. So the guy that has to put up a sign, warning, junk.
Right.
That's what, if I go into Sash and Sash has a rack of mistakes, what do they call it?
Irregular.
They can't blend them in with the others and say,
suits. Actually, you go for Boaz, we're going to have the opposite.
Right.
But, can I throw one more example out? 1,000 years ago, this does not leave the room. I used to be a philatelist. I used to collect stamps. Everything I have of value is in the Falls in Minnesota. And I learned from a dealer, a trusted dealer in Atlanta who did not take advantage of me, but he showed me how a lot of the game works. A specimen that's perfectly set, I don't think, without going into all the detail, described with perfect angst, a specimen that was centered extremely well. And it sounded to me, I'm not going into all the things, and then he showed me, he said, but it had a bullet hole in the center of it, meaning the stamp is still ruined, but the perforation of it comes around as a shape. But unfortunately, let the buyer beware. He showed me what can happen. It's a market to trust me. You're too trusting. This is you have to, whenever possible, inspect the goods. This is a lot of work.
So let's talk about this principle.
Next, any buyers do that.
Check out those.
They're looking at the seams. They've got everything inside out. So
listen, I'm in that area. Check out those means I bought something. I thought I was buying one thing.
Check
out tahut. Tahus. I thought I was buying one thing, and it turns out I'm buying something else. Meaning, I thought I was buying a mother of pearl watch, and turns out it's Fisher Price. I thought I was buying a car that drives. It's going to tell me there's no battery. It's going to tell me there's no transmission. I thought I was buying a real CD. Turns out it's so... No. So the question is, in that case, on the street, it's a little bit different. But in the setting where I paid... Right at the very beginning of this lesson, how does transactions work? Both parties are willingly parting with their property. The seller is parting with his merchandise. The buyer is parting with his money. Why? Because they both are getting what they want. If they're not getting what they want, then there is a measure of stealing on that. Therefore, the transaction is invalid from the get-go. If I went into a store and I bought a box with a big picture of a vacuum cleaner, and I come home and I find inside a toaster, I'm going back to the store and I'm saying, give me back my money. Take back your box. Because it was a transaction held under, give me a word, under mistaken premises. But not necessarily misrepresentation. Because what if the seller didn't know? Somebody. Well, let's say the seller didn't know. Let's say I buy a pet from a pet shop and I can take it home and it's all rough dead from a heart attack. The seller didn't know. He had a congenital heart attack. You go back to the store and they say, oops, sorry, we didn't realize. We'll give you another one. Why? Because when you purchase the dog, even though Howard says you don't know how these things work out,
you fully expect that what you're getting. So the first principle that we have is misrepresentation. That is deliberate misstating of the facts. But the second principle is, there's such a thing as, there's no ill will happening here. There was no deliberate misrepresentation. There was just, the transaction was done under mistaken information. The transaction is invalid.
Whatever, just an error. Somebody's error.
Right.
Yeah, I did. You said that this way, the misrepresentative guy from like the market came now.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy said, well, he never had to explain to it in that way.
By the way, it can work the reverse as well. Not just the seller that has to worry about this. The seller sells something that he thought was worth a good deal of money, and the purchaser purchases it, and then he comes back and he says, well, it's a piece of junk. The sale was off. It works the other way around. Somebody mentioned garage sales. You go to a garage sale, and you see a Picasso that the guy's selling for 25 cents.
I was going to say this earlier. You brought it up.
This is...
You see a stamp that's upside down stamp, the upside down airplane stamp, one that's, you know, somewhere, and you know the stamp, and you know it's there, and it's in with a bunch of stamps, a guy selling for $40. And you know it's a $5 million stamp.
Really?
Can you buy the stamp?
Well, there's something in the revenge literature about a Jew who bought a cow, or some cattle, from an Arab, and it had a pearl. There's a gem that's embedded in the fur that the seller didn't know. You brought it back. You had a deal on buying your cow at a good price. That did not include this gem. And then the Arabs was, you know, blessed be the God of the Hebrews. Yeah, I don't remember which might have been. It's somewhere in the Talmud.
So the answer would be...
You tell him that the thing's worth $5
million and he needs to give him $1 million.
Not yet. It depends.
Wow.
In the case of the garage sale, the guy thinks he's selling junk, and it's really a great value. In the case of business, if he knows it's a valuable stamp, he thinks it's worth 100, and it's really worth 1,000. That's business. But if he thinks it's not worth anything, he thinks it's just an old stamp, then you, as the buyer, become as a wait. This is valuable stuff. So it's a little bit of a fine line.
So business versus real life is different?
Even in business, there's real life.
He's trying to sell a $100 stamp, or he's trying to sell a stamp in with a bunch of 40 stamps that's worth $5 million. You need to tell him that your information has value. He's worked a long time, and he's lost his work on stamps.
In other words, there's nothing wrong with getting it wrong, but there is something wrong if it's based on misunderstanding or misinformation. So if the guy thinks he's selling a piece of junk, but it's really a Picasso, this is not a fair transaction. If he thinks a Picasso was worth $1,000 and Unova is worth $5,000, he says, look, I'm willing to take that chance. But the guy knows going in what we're dealing with. Another thing. And I say $1,000 to $5,000, but not necessarily so.
Even though this is difficult, I'm sorry.
What?
Because that means the seller is entitled to some part, but if the seller really knew,
there's a principle in Jewish law called Ona'ah. Ona'ah from the Torah word on page 10, text 4a. The text reads, when you make a sale to your fellow or make a purchase from the hand of your fellow, you shall not wrong one another. The Hebrew word, lo al tonu. What is tonu? You shall not something or other. So from there we get the word onaha, which means wrong. I translate it as gouge, as in price gouge. Says the Talmud, where does this literally don't wrong one another? That's not a law. You can't tell me do not wrong one another. You have to be more specific. Says the Talmud, okay, here I'll tell you what price gouging is. That's 4b. Less than a sixth, sale is binding. More than a sixth, the sale is canceled. Exactly a sixth, the sale is binding, and the onaha is refunded. What is this talking about? What is the sixth?
Six times?
The sixth of the value of whatever the object is.
Or six times?
One sixth. No, not six times. Six. One sixth. This is not...
A $60 transaction, if it's $10, then we have to... the sale is binding and ONA is refunded. If it's $9...
$9 what?
$9. $9 of the 60.
$9 of the
$60 stamp. The guy thinks it's worth $10.
I know it's worth $60 in the market. It's worth 10. The guy's offered 10. We make the transaction. The rabbi looks at the transaction later and says, it was $10. The transaction still stands.
Okay. Almost, but you went the other way.
Market,
because
you know, you think
the price gathering
when you have the
disaster. Right. So get that 1 second. Let me explain what the six is. 1 sixth away from fair market value. If you are charging more than 1 sixth more than fair market value, you're gouging. If you are paying less than 1 sixth less than fair market value, you're underpaying. There's a law here that says you're not allowed to do that.
And that's just the fair market value. What are the people setting the fair market value for both sellers?
Well, it's not the people who sell it. There's a market. There's not the people who sell it. There's a market. And there's a fluctuation.
You've got to make a profit. It's okay to make a profit.
Absolutely.
So if that number dollar question made this water and put it in here,
people have water right here, and I bought a 24-pack of water at Publix, and I went to a big crowded place where I knew that the sun was all 100 degrees, and I said, I see you sweating, and I said, you know, how about a bottle of water for $5?
Absolutely. Is that market value?
No. That's
crazy.
But wait.
Why?
Because you know it's only worth
a dollar. No. It's not worth a dollar. We'll make it worth a dollar.
Exactly
right.
Yeah.
If you say, you know what?
Like Jerry Seinfeld says, you go to the store at the airport, you buy a bottle of water. Do these people know what water costs in the rest of the planet? Or a ball game? Or a movie theater when you pay, you know, $7 or 7 cents worth of... But is that price gouging? Is that price gouging?
$7
or 7 cents of popcorn?
Yeah, pretty much
price. Hang on, let me ask you something. I have a tree, or a competition, that you could be selling for $8. Somebody's selling Jimmy Choo's shoes for $350. You go down the block, and you see the same pair of shoes for $100. Is somebody overcharging you? Or is somebody undercharging you? Wait a second. I gave this example last night. You go into Best Buy, and you see a big screen TV. And it costs $1,000. You go down the road to another store, same big screen TV. They're charging $5,000. But when you walk into the store, you're immediately greeted with a cup of coffee. They put you into a very nice couch, and they bring you each... As you want to see something, they bring you the item. Would you like this? They show it. They plug it in for you. They fire it up. They take care of you.
I'll take them business.
In other words, they're saying also informs the market value. So buying a bottle of water right here and now, if it's worth a dollar. Buying a bottle of water on the field where I'm running around and schwitzing and I'm, you know. So fair market value is a very tricky thing. But it can be assessed. And then on top of that, what's 1/6? 15%?
Thereabouts.
15%.
So
15% profit, not a problem. More than that, 15% of a not profit, 15% more than fair market value.
We had a pollinator in April. I got a generator. He goes in running off where the gas plane. So I need to go get 5 gallons of gas. So there's one fill station over. I said, how much is a gallon of gas? He said, $10.
That's price gouging, no?
So what if I don't do that? I said, well, I won't buy it. Well, I'll keep my house, you know, running and all. Right. And we'll do that. Maybe you're a gouger.
Right. But Paula brings up something.
You don't go there again when you can. Right. When you could do business with him, you don't.
But Paula brings up something interesting. As soon as there's a tornado or a hurricane in the Gulf, and a couple of gas platforms go down, oil platforms go down, and suddenly there are lines around the block at the gas stations, the governor makes an announcement, if you raise the prices, you're going to jail. Is that right? What is the market value? Fair market value. And if there's a shortage of gas, guess what happens to the price? It goes up. Why not?
In the same thing.
Supply
and demand, right? So why shouldn't it go up?
Availability in hotels.
There's a shortage of rabbis. My salary didn't go up.
Hey? So Paula, why shouldn't it go up? The only valid answer that I heard was because oil, or in this case gasoline, is a little bit different from popcorn and even water bottles. In that if people stop purchasing gasoline, the country will come to a standstill. And of course, with gas in our cars, we're not going to go to work, we're not going to get anything done. And so, in a crisis situation, they override the market and say we're going to force a lower price until we get back on our feet.
Well, at the limited gasoline, I can remember when people were selling chainsaws and things like that, taking them in, and I think the government can't raise prices on any of
it. Did that happen with Katrina and people for what they did raise the price of all that lumber and people were pushing for that because they said it was.
But even for the service, if you're going to charge more based because you can get it, and because you have traveled there, and so your $20 an hour is now $45 an hour if you want my skill as a carpenter.
It's all dependent on there being some good people with good will that...
Right, so fair market value, what is it? You said it can be assessed, correct? How
by those who understand the market. And for example, knowing that gasoline is $3 a gallon here, but if you go out in the countryside where there's a gas station that's 25 miles, it's worth $4, $5 a gallon. But it's not worth $6 because if you make it $6, that's worth the commuter drive back into town. There's a way to do this. Right? Cost analysis, whatever. Now, we're talking about mekato, meaning a purchase done under misinformation, versus price gouging. They sort of go together. Because it's only gouging if it's not worth it. So if I'm buying something that the seller knows is not that valuable, he is not only selling you something on the list of misinformation, he's also price gouging. This broken toaster is not worth $45. Because it's broken. So sometimes they go together, sometimes they don't. Let's go back to Cicero's house. According to everything we know now, remember the defective house is sanitary, and Jupiter said he has to disclose that. And Diogenes said, no, as long as you just
don't lie,
you're okay. According to the Torah, according to Allah, which of these rules of Greva Das, lying, misrepresenting something? That's one principle. Another principle is mekatos, to purchase done without the necessary information. And three, price gouging. Which of those three would apply?
Misinformation.
Yeah,
misinformation meaning deliberately misleading or simply a purchase done under...
All is intentional misrepresentation of something.
That's a better word. So, Geneva thought is fraud. Mekatos is... There was not enough information going around, and I purchased something without knowing what I was purchasing.
You know what the word maker means in Yiddish,
though, is a stir. Okay. This is Mecca. So it would appear that we're going to follow at Jupiter and say you have to come clean. But don't we believe the contract?
But if it costs you money, is someone really going to do that? You know,
going to do what?
Come
clean.
Come back clean. By law, you have to go to a certain extent.
This is a question in every area of law.
It's a word, though. Contract.
Yeah.
A contract.
All that fine print, all that.
Yeah. What if the contract says the words, those famous words, as is? Look at page 13 for a moment. Look at page 13.
There's something the matter with it, though.
What's text 5A?
Somebody's raking leaves in your front yard, and you watch them rake the leaves in the front yard, and then they come up and say, hey, that'll be $5. Do you owe them $5? Do you watch them rake the leaves?
Hey, yeah, that was the whistle washers.
No, what was the answer?
They didn't know.
Sure, you owe them $5.
Wait, did you ask them to do it?
You don't have
$5.
You got a service done for you. You knew it was being provided for you. That kind of something.
You did not buy them.
It's a contract.
I don't know about that.
Did you owe that $5? You had knowledge he was providing a service of that.
Wow.
Interesting.
You received that service. Somebody sends something to me. I'm sorry, we gotta go. Somebody sends something to me. You get an order. Not a mistake about it. You ordered one thing, they sent two of them, or something different, but you received some kind of promotion, and then they send you a bill for it later.
Well, you receive something in value, sure. By keeping it, you establish contract.
Unless I have to pay to send it back.
No, that's they're responsible
right.
for getting their
product
back.
That's we're running out of time.
Yeah,
we
got to sweep up the whole backyard.
All stipulations in monetary matters are valid.
As long as both sides agree,
three.
That's called a contract. Howard, help me out. You can write a contract. As long as, it's not
illegal, immoral, against public policy.
That's it. You can write a contract. And if both sides agree to a contract, and the Talmud agrees with that. However, it needs to be more than just a contract. It has to be clear. This is where the fine print comes in. Text 5B reads, the person tells a colleague, we are completing this transaction on the condition that you do not hold me responsible for Ona'a. In other words, you can't blame me if I charge a little too much. Says the Talmud, that's not a decision of mine. Says the Rambam, the laws of Ona'a still apply. That's not a stipulation. Why? It's not specific enough. When is the exclusion of Maimonides when a statement is made without being explicit? In such an instance, the disadvantaged party doesn't know the extent of the Ona'a, and therefore he is not really properly relinquishing his claim. Next paragraph. For example, if the seller says to the purchaser, I am aware that this object that I am selling you for 200 sous is only worth 100. That's 100% profit, right? That's more than 16%. Not 100% profit. It's 100% gouging. Yeah. Yet, I am selling it to you on the condition that you do not hold me responsible for owning the house. In this case, that is a valid stipulation. Why? Because the buyer agreed to it. Exactly right. So yes, we do believe in sign the contract.
Yeah, verbally or
sign it. Oh,
yeah.
Well,
verbally, he can say,
right. You can do it verbally, but you can never prove it.
Yeah.
Okay. So even with a contract, there is such a thing as yeah, but he didn't realize the extent of. It's got to be that specific. It was 100. That's worth 200, and so on. So the business of the house. We seem to agree with that typically. You have to come clean. You have to say this is not a usable house, not a livable house, whatever it is. Let's quickly look at another case. If you have
remember
right, exactly. Page 15. Suppose there's a food shortage and famine at Rhodes. This is Cicero again. There's a food shortage and a famine at Rhodes, and the price of corn is extremely high. An honest man has bought the Rhodians a large stock of corn from Alexandria. Now, he is aware that a number of other traders are on their way from Alexandria because he has seen their ships making for Rhodes with substantial cargoes of grain. Ought he tell the Rhodians this? What's going to happen when the other ships get there? Their price is going to go down. He's the first one there. Does he have to tell the folks, look, I know you guys are paying $1 a pound because there's not enough to go around, but there will be tomorrow.
That's
a heavy Does he? Or is he to say nothing and sell his stock at the best price he can get? I am assuming that if he is an enlightened, honest person, I'm asking him to consider the liberation and the self-searching of the sort of man who would not keep the Rhodians in ignorance if he thought this would be dishonest, but it was not certain that dishonesty would be involved. Question is, would he be dishonest to continue charging famine rates when he knows that tomorrow...
We just watched them.
Exactly right.
But they're still in the famine today.
They're in the famine, and everything is fine today, but he's got insider information. This is exactly insider trading.
He
says, in cases of this kind, an eminent and respected scholar named Diogenes of Babylon habitually takes one side and his very clever pupil Antipater of Tarsus takes the other side. Antipater says that all the facts must be revealed, and the purchaser must be as fully informed as the seller. According to Diogenes, on the other hand, the seller must declare the effects of his words as far as the law of the land requires, but otherwise, provided he is not telling no untruths, he is entitled, as a seller of goods to sell them as profitably as he can. I have brought my cargo, I offered it for sale, and I offered it cheaper than everybody else, I'm not overpricing it. So he goes.
Well, the other side is that tomorrow may not really happen. That ship could be delayed. It might sink. It
could be.
So I can see where the second would apply.
These are the problems. These are the problems inherent in the free market.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like it or not, I'm just speaking, and I'm not happy with what I'm saying, but the value for your market, it's all going to come down to one individual.
Well, let's look at that six.
That's what we're
going to give it to you all today.
take them only for a call.
Read that six. Yes. Yeah.
All right. With regard to commerce, if we do not share it, perhaps in this list or so in another place, or that in the future we were such and such, we consider only, we only consider the current time and place.
So yeah, how do you measure fair market value? Not by guessing what's going to happen tomorrow.
Now.
Right. That's it.
Yes.
On the other hand, before we jump to conclusions, conference read text number 7A.
Narda,
yeah.
There was once a food shortage in Narda. Yep. All the people sold their mansions in exchange for food. Eventually, we'd arrive. Rob Nachman said, the law is that the homes must return to their owners. There were causes of mistaken sales where it became apparent that at the time of the sales, the ship, carrying the wheat, was standing in the side streams of the river right outside the city.
He said that the sale of the houses in order to get food was a case of mistaken business, mistaken transactions. Why? Because the food was right outside the city. They just didn't know.
Right. So it wasn't equitable to give up your mansion.
Right.
For the food.
Yeah, well, that's...
Yeah.
Now, look at
that precious little
herb.
I mean, it's so gorgeous. Okay, sorry.
And it turns out, the Bachman's ruling does not apply to most cases.
Well, because it's...
It's a very rare instance of selling a home.
Mansion.
A mansion.
The word mansion versus just a home or a place of dwelling.
So because it was something so unusual that it must have been done under the greatest duress, and had they known that they could have waited another day, another week, this would never have done. So therefore he invalidated sales. But in most cases, you don't say what's going to happen tomorrow would affect the price. You don't say what's happening in another town affects the price. Therefore, let's look at this merchant in Rhodes. Does he have to tell the Rhodians that tomorrow the price is going to go down?
So if I know that an $11 price going to be published, but we're really only going to sell it for 10. What do you say? I mean, what's ethical there? I mean, do you say, okay, we're going to publish this price at $11, but we're going to sell it for 10? Not just because it's usually good listed.
A lot of it depends on, and again, this goes back to the local law and custom, a lot of it depends on how business is generally transacted.
Sure, they want a lower price, obviously. But also so does Target or Walmart and, you know,
your public. But every business is different. And if I would give the example of the hamarim, the donkey drivers, I guess the porters, right, the donkey drivers, they charge 1 zuz for the first 10 miles and 1 zuz for every additional mile. 1 zuz for 10 miles and then 1 zuz per mile, that's price gouging. That's enough. That's the way the business works. Within 10 miles, that's what we do. Outside 10 miles, like the city, like New York City taxi. Outside the city, the rate goes up.
Right.
That's not called gouging, but that's how the business works. So you have to know the business in order to understand if it's gouging.
Right.
The first hour, free. Every additional hour,
only
late. Therefore you say, you're telling me something as if I know what you're talking about. We're going to publish one price and sell it for another price. I never heard of that. I go to the store and I see the price tag, I don't know if that's what I'm going to pay. How does somebody get away with paying a dollar less? Answer, that's how the business works. Published prices, actual prices, right? So a lot of this is knowing the local business custom.
In effect, that makes buying an auto business. But that's not morally, but
you know, that happens a lot. No, not at all. The way business works, unless the whole business is immoral. But the common business practice is considered the right way to do things. So, for example, if Torah recognizes the validity of a handshake, and if Torah considers the handshake binding, because that's what you expect it to be, because that's how the business works.
So, your word, isn't it? Your word is binding. Your
word is binding as a person, but in the business practice. When the guy says, oh, wow, you know, I'll pay you $10 for that. Wait, I was just joking.
But it used to be...
That's different from a handshake.
You were your word, though, years ago. You were your handshake and your word.
Anyway, it turns out... very, very quickly, let's turn to page... 19. There's the chart with the Torah text on the middle of the page, and then two interesting laws based on that on the outside of the page. The middle of the page, the Torah text reads, "You shall not see your brother's ox or sheep straying and ignore them. Rather, you shall return them to your fellow." This is the mitzvah of returning lost objects. The mitzvah to return something that's lost. Now look at text A on the left side. Mm-hmm. "One who sees water threatening to flood another's field or destroy another's building must try to stop it. As the verse says, any lost article of your fellow. In any instance that one can save another from loss, one must do so with all one's might." So, preventing somebody else from losing money, preventing somebody else from suffering a loss, is part of the mitzvah of returning lost objects. Therefore, you have a mandate, you are commanded, to help prevent someone else's loss.
These are
objects, not money,
though, is it?
No, this is in the business.
Money,
objects, good. So, if somebody's water is running to destroy a guy's field, he's going to lose his crops.
I'm going to help him.
What else?
The animal fell in the hole.
On the other hand, how far does this loss extend? Let's look at Hex B. However, one does not need to spend money for this mitzvah. What do you mean? He goes, do I have to spend money and build a wall along his field?
Yes.
If I can, push the button, turn the sluice gate or whatever, if I can do something, do it. But spend money, unless one knows for sure that the owner of the lost object would be happy to repay him. Hence, the obligation of returning lost objects does not apply to one who will forfeit financial gain by taking the time to return the object.
Wow. That's a shame out there. But that doesn't sound right.
Well, you're not supposed to take your own loss to prevent somebody else from losing. The mitzvah that says that you have to do your best to prevent somebody else from taking the loss does not require you to take a loss.
Does that
make sense?
No, it doesn't.
You should incur a loss so that they don't incur a loss.
Well, I don't know that you're just going to stop and think about that loss that you're incurring or costing you.
So, that's the question. Do you have a feeling? I have a very famous example, and the Rabbi is going to help you. We are traveling through the desert, and we're out of food, and we're rusted without the one bottle of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I drink it, I'll live. I'll make it to the city. If he drinks it, he lives. He'll make it to the city. If we both drink it, we ain't going to make it. That was one guy. The one was Alaka. The Alaka is, it's in my hands, I get to drink it. No, I'm not going to do that. That's called murder.
That's like, okay.
In other words,
I get the concept, but I don't know that I agree with
it. Let me settle. In other words, the mitzvah to prevent somebody else from incurring the loss, which would then cause me to suffer a loss, is circular reason. Then that guy has a mitzvah to come out and stop me from preventing him because you'll be there forever.
But then you never do anything if you don't think you're going to be reimbursed for it. I mean, is that...
So pushing somebody out of the way of the rolling rock down the hill, and you know it's going to kill you if you push them out of the way. Are you supposed to kill yourself if you push them out of the way? Remember that class?
No.
What you do, he's a threat.
wow, it's like, I found out I should have stayed in the airport on Friday night, not gotten on that plane to get home at 2:30 in the morning, which is obvious, but I shouldn't stay somebody else's life because I'm going to get killed. I mean, it's like, wow, I mean, how do you have time to think all that?
Why not?
Well, I'm
not on
Friday.
No, I get that. I'm
in a life-threatening situation. It's different, obviously. We'll talk about what
I can argue against the However, when it's to restore even the guy who not only when is the wandering donkey, you don't understand compassion yet because in the state of snorting ecstasy, you see the ox of